Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Welcome to the Vegan Report. My name is Ryan, and today I challenge you to dream of a world where 2 billion Muslims, inspired by their faith, decide to become vegan and embrace the animal cause. At the forefront of making this dream a reality is Green Islam, an initiative of Kind World Media that reminds Muslims of how modern consumption and lifestyle practices are incompatible with the original ethical spirit of Islam. To discuss this pioneering work, I have with me none other than the founder of Kind World Media and Green Islam, Zehra Abbas. I asked Zehra what to make of Eid al-Adha, an Islamic holiday celebrated by families with the sacrifice of a sheep, why she thinks halal meat is a scam, how vegan activists are failing to reach the Muslim world, and much, much more. If you are interested in learning more about the Islamic world and veganism, you can also listen to El Ma'arri, The World's First Vegan, episode 37, and Lebanon Goes Vegan, episode 38 of The Vegan Report. In the meantime, please subscribe and share this episode with your fellow vegan. The stories we cover here are meaningful and deserve your attention. Thank you. Thinking about our conversation, I remembered another conversation I had with a human rights activist. It was years ago, and I was talking about veganism to this activist, and the first thing she said was, and this was in the context of a discussion about international relations, and the first thing she said was, but veganism is a bit culturally insensitive. And the example she gave was Eid al-Adha, you know. And she said, pushing the vegan agenda would be insensitive to people who celebrate Eid al-Adha, for instance. So I ask you the same question. Is it culturally insensitive to push veganism onto people who celebrate Eid al-Adha? And maybe also, what is Eid al-Adha?
Well, I love we're starting off with the hard-hitting stuff. I love it. that's a great question and probably a pretty common misconception. The thing is we have in Islam quite a few schools of thought. We have 4 school of thoughts under Sunni Islam, and then there's also Shia Islam. Now, the Sunni school of thought and I'm just sharing with you what I'm most familiar with. Out of the 4 Sunni schools of thought, there's 1 school of thought that believes that it is mandatory or required to slaughter an animal. The rest do not believe that. The rest believe that we should commemorate in terms of a sacrifice, because what we know is that a prophet, Abraham, may peace be upon him, he believed that he was asked to sacrifice his son, that which was dearest to him, and he believed that that's what God was asking of him, and his son, of course, said, okay, if that's what needs be. However, there was the son was replaced by a ram that came from the heavens. And so, yes, there are a group of Muslims who believe that we must slaughter an animal. However, there is also a different thought, which is that we must sacrifice. And what that can look like is sacrificing, the funds you'd saved for the next new phone you were going to buy or the next car you were going to buy, right? Is taking that money or taking time out of your busy schedule to volunteer. There are many ways to sacrifice, and through charitable giving or through a variety of other ways we can engage in the concept of sacrifice, and it really doesn't need to be animals. And there are scholars who have spoken about this. There are videos online. And so for those that believe it's required, I would just encourage them to dig a little bit deeper.
And what do you make of the cultural insensitive part?
I don't think that it's culturally insensitive at all. I think that to be sensitive is to be compassionate, to be kind. It's to and when we look at it's interesting that she evoked something from Islam that she believed, because Islam is all about peace and compassion and kindness and thoughtfulness. And Islam is rife with instruction on how to care for animals. It makes today's slaughterhouses and animal farms pretty much non-permissible in Islam, because there are so many rules, extensive rules, in how we're supposed to treat animals. In fact, within Islam, we have so many teachings and so many stories that instill in us that one act of cruelty from a pious Muslim towards an animal can lead them to hellfire, whereas a non-pious person or a non-Muslim or somebody who may be sinning in other ways, one act of kindness towards an animal could have all of their sins forgiven. And so we are a tradition, we're people that really prioritize caring for animals. And it's very beautiful once you dig into the teachings and learn the teachings. Then I think it's actually about it's reframed this perspective into caring for animals is actually the real tradition. And it's coming back to the roots by exercising compassion and care for animals.
Beautiful. And let's get back to the Eid al-Adha. There are some assumptions that we have as vegans and vegan activists. One of them is if people had to kill the animal in order to eat the animal, they would not do it. And when I see Eid al-Adha, I think this goes against that profound assumption that we have on people, because it becomes normalized, to sacrifice an animal and to make it, a family event, a ceremonial, religious event with a high significance. And I guess, the challenge is how do we pierce through that conditioning to reach people? Did you ever, think about it?
Absolutely. This is a great I feel like it's actually someone from a similar cultural background can understand this perspective or even have this thought or consideration, because it does seem like in the sanitized lives that we live here in North America, for example, we don't see slaughter. It is tucked away, and I think the vast majority of us would be horrified. At least I would like to believe the vast majority of us would be horrified if we saw that. I was born in Pakistan, and I did see slaughter. I was there until I was about 6 years old, and I did see slaughter, and it was distasteful, but it was normal. And In fact, culturally, as you mentioned, it can be a family celebration. Folks will bring animals to their home, decorate the animals, my goodness, and like before the slaughter, right? It's a family activity, and that desensitizes children to the act of slaughter, and it becomes normalized. And over time, then it's very comfortable for people to conduct the slaughter themselves because there is a sense of detachment or greater purpose or something along those lines. What's interesting is that the UN Committee for Child Rights has recently used child slaughter as an example of child abuse because it has a traumatic effect on a child's brain. And so it does make sense that within those communities where kids are exposed so early on and taught to to become desensitized to it, it is, in fact, they're normal. And it also makes sense that folks who live and grow up in these countries where they don't see any blood or guts or slaughter or anything horrible, if they as adults are then confronted with the reality of what's happening in a slaughterhouse, would probably be quite repelled by it.
Yes, I had the same childhood background. I've seen countless, I think, slaughterings of sheep, and it's always in the back of my mind. When vegans talk about, spreading veganism, that there's a large part of this world's population that is not that impacted by, I guess, footage of slaughter or the act of slaughter itself. That language of compassion and look how horrible this is doesn't, sound the same, ring the same way. And I feel that there's something lacking there in terms of activism, of language and tactics used to reach more people. Have you brainstormed any solutions?
I think that what's really been effective for me, at least with advocacy within the Muslim community, I learned early on as a vegan who cared so deeply about extending the vegan message to folks. I learned early on that you have to meet people where they are. And truly, the learning the teachings of Islam around animal rights and me learning about them brought me closer to Islam. And I think that when I speak with a Muslim audience that is a practicing Muslim audience that really care about Islam and Islamic teachings and doing their best to follow them, I find that I have the easiest time advocating to them or with them because they'll immediately recognize that Islam is very clear on animal rights and we're not following those rules. And so it's almost easier than the person who doesn't really care. We've all met those folks who just say, I don't care what's happening to the animals. And that I find perplexing. I don't know how to respond to that. I don't know how to respond to somebody who doesn't care. But speaking with people who do care, it's actually immediately we find common ground. And what I find is lacking there is just simply a lack of knowledge or all the reasons we know why people don't necessarily go vegan, which is, convenience, having a social network, accessibility, and knowledge is a big piece, not just knowledge around what's happening with animals and all the impacts on from climate to public health, the grave impacts of animal farming. It's such an extensive piece to download in terms of knowledge. But then there's also a big piece of, well, now what do we eat and what do we buy? Because when folks haven't been thinking about these things, I know for me, it was a bit of a learning curve. I had to almost relearn food. And so there has to be a deep commitment. And I find it easier to reach with folks who are really trying to follow Islam well.
And I want to hear those arguments. And I'm really interested about the halal part. I think lots of people are intrigued by that concept of halal, but they've seen that all around, in the city or something, the supermarket. How did we get there? How did the Muslim world get to that place of, mass slaughters of animals for Eid al-Adha? or this acceptance, I guess, or tolerance of slaughterhouses and factory farming, if they are even aware of them existing. How did we get to that place?
I think when we want something, it becomes really easy to fool ourselves into something. I think that's why halal today isn't at all about animal welfare, even though the halal rules originally came down in regards to the welfare of animals or the care for animals. And today it's the vast majority of Muslims that I have interacted with sincerely believe that halal means ethical, that halal means the animals are treated well and it's not from those factory farms, because that wouldn't be halal. I think the vast majority have simply not thought about what halal really means. And I know for myself, when I was younger, I used to go with my family to a halal slaughterhouse. It's actually not even a halal slaughterhouse. It's just a chicken slaughterhouse that had certain days where they made halal. They made their chicken halal, and they you could go there and buy chicken breast and chicken wings and ground chicken in bulk. And so it was the best prices. And you would stand in line because there was a customer area specifically for the day that they would open up to the public. And you would line up and then go place your order for these boxes and buy them in bulk. And it's so bizarre that I thought that that was acceptable. I thought that that meant these animals were treated well, and that, you know, there was nothing potentially problematic about engaging in this. And it was only when I came across an investigation that was done on this particular slaughterhouse on cruelty, and they were fined, I believe, for cruelty towards animals, that I thought, well, how could a halal slaughterhouse be charged with cruelty? How do those two things, how can I reconcile that? And so the more I dug into it, the more I realized, oh, it's not true. It's not real. This isn't really halal. This is, you know, we're getting hoodwinked. And so I became vegetarian. And I remember having a couple of thoughts, because I also came across other investigations and learned that the turkey producer also selling halal turkey also has been charged with cruelty. And that's when I said, okay, I'm going to go vegetarian. And that was fairly easy. It wasn't very difficult to be vegetarian. And I found that I had a couple of thoughts here and there about, well, where does dairy come from? Or what about eggs? And what are the circumstances behind that? And are there enough cows? Because I live in the suburb, at the time I lived in the suburb, but very close to the city. So I don't really see cows. So I remember thinking, where are all the cows to make enough milk? And do they just make milk all the, or are there that many pregnant cows that are producing all this milk that's available in every convenience store and any place I might go, or any grocery store that I might go to? Where are all the cows that produce this? Maybe there's not a whole lot of milk in the milk, right? I remember thinking that. And making a note in my brain, oh, I've got to research this, or I've got to look into this. And then I just didn't, because I got distracted with this, that, or the other. And it wasn't until one day somebody said in front of me, as they were speaking with one of their friends, they said, if only people knew that dairy is so much worse than meat. And I remember at that time thinking, what is he talking about? And going home and researching it. And then that was my journey. So I think the vast majority of folks are A, not thinking about it, B, particularly in the Muslim community, convinced that we have divine permission. And if it's halal, it is divinely done. It's we're practicing it in a divine way. And so therefore, nothing could be wrong with this picture. Everything's tickety-boo.
So then who is responsible of that label, the halal label? I guess I never asked myself that question, but is there like a international organization or something that takes care of that?
There are a lot of certifying bodies, and as far as I understand, they're localized. So Canada has our own, UK has their own, US has their own, and then within the countries, there can be different certification organizations. So there's not just one. When I was younger and there were less Muslims here in the Greater Toronto Area, there was, I believe, one main one, but now there's multiple. And so that's the thing, is just about anyone can form a certification body and say, well, this is what, to get our certificate, you have to meet this criteria. And when you go on their websites and look up what that criteria is, you'll find that animal welfare is generally missing from the equation. There was one organization or one butcher place that was serving grass-fed, pasture-raised, organic, hand-slaughtered meat. And I remember associating that with the most ethical available. And this must be the humane farms. This is the true halal, I thought. And I remember asking the assistant manager of this butcher shop when I was picking up some chicken from there, how much space the chicken has when they say grass fed or pasture raised and all that. What does that mean when it comes to the life of a chicken or the life of a cow or a goat? And he said, well, they have enough space. And he was quite dismissive. He said, oh, yeah, they have enough space. And I said, well, how much space do they have? And he said, oh, it's enough space for them to spread their wings. And in that moment, I thought, oh, this is another form of us having the wool pulled over our eyes. Excuse the non-vegan expression there. But it certainly was a moment of, it was an opportunity at that time for me to either say, I'm going to shrug this under the rug. It's not, I'm going to hide it under the rug. It's not my responsibility because they're telling me it's ethical. So now it's really their responsibility if they're not doing it right. I'm doing my best. Or the opportunity to say, I'm not okay with this. I cannot support this. Right. And I really am so grateful for the investigation videos that I happened to watch, because had I not seen the extreme amount of cruelty within the slaughterhouses and within animal farming in general, even on the so-called humane farms, I don't know if I would have had the empathy or the connection with the animals to make such a big jump. Because in our community, it really is. I mean, in society as a whole, but then particularly in the Muslim community, it's a whole host of very different objections that you are faced with continuously. So as a vegan person in the broader society, you're asked a lot about your health, right? Like, where do you get your protein? What about your B12? What about calcium? And, aren't animals here for us to eat? And those kind of concepts. But within the Muslim community, there's a lot of, but God said you can eat animals. Are you defying God? Right? And so that gets a lot more complicated within that context. And I'm sure so many different communities have their own version of that.
Well, that's I think the most interesting part. How do you navigate those objections, and how, because I feel like for many people, you would be the first person that ever mentioned veganism or has denounced, what's happening with the halal business to them. Like, you're breaking the news. I don't know of many other, and you tell me of many other vegan advocacy initiatives directed to Muslim communities. So, yeah, how do you navigate those objections?
There are quite a few in Muslim countries, wonderful organizations like the Middle East Vegan Society that are doing really great advocacy and really great community building. I think that everyone's kind of working within their geographical location, for the most part. And Because we're such a diverse community. There's about 2 billion of us on planet Earth, almost quarter of the world's population. And so the vegan Muslim activists that I know, or Muslim adjacent activists that I know, are advocating in so many different languages, in so many different Muslim predominant countries. And I think we're slowly growing. I think as more people become aware, more people are making the decision to leap into veganism, and it's a whole different experience to then become a full-time advocate or a regular advocate, right? Many people start practicing themselves, but aren't necessarily comfortable expressing in front of others. And it really is a lot of, it takes a lot of time and work to accumulate all of the reasons so that we can be effective advocates. So you do have to learn a little bit about environmental science, and you have to learn about various slaughterhouses, and you have to learn about health, so many things about health, right? And so I think it's not easy, but slowly and surely we're getting there.
When I welcome religious leaders on this podcast, I always ask, what is the value of making the religious argument for veganism? So I ask you the same question.
The religious argument. Wow, okay. It's a great question. I'm sure you've gotten so many great answers. I think the religious argument is fairly simple. It says in the Quran, yes, we are Muslims are given permission within the Quran to eat animals, specific animals. However, it also says in the Quran that we can eat that which is halal and tayyib, which means permissible and pure. And tayyib, pure, it means both morally as well as physically. Now we turn to the hadith, the sayings of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and the understanding of his lifestyle to then understand what that really means. What does it mean that we can eat halal and tayyib? And what that means is that we cannot slaughter an animal in front of another, that they cannot be distressed. They cannot see blood, smell blood, even hear another slaughtered. They should not see the knife before being slaughtered. There is a specific way that things are allowed. And in today's animal farming, that way is nearly impossible. It's impossible. We cannot separate babies from their mothers. And animal farming depends on that. There is a lot of interference. When we speak about the concept of pure, we are breeding animals, and there is human interference and involvement in cruel ways to breed animals into existence. The Quran speaks about us destroying destruction and corruption of the earth, land, and seas, and that is precisely what we're doing with animal farming. We are not supposed to uproot a tree in battle, and yet we are uprooting so many trees for a very, very cruel industry. So that there is immense responsibility on Muslims to be stewards and vice regents. And we are simply unable to meet that requirement of us if we are engaging in any way with animal farming today, because of the environmental impact, because of the public health impact, and most importantly, because of what we're doing to the animals directly. We're simply not allowed to do those things.
Do you feel like this type of argument for a Muslim is more convincing and impactful than the usual arguments we hear from, let's say, secular vegans? I get that feeling that the religious lane in the vegan movement and the animal rights activism space is not really that much explored, that there isn't that much invested when the potential is so great. What do you make of that?
We do the best we can with what's available to us. And I think that when it comes to it might be a bit repetitive, but really when people are following religion, they're interested in following religion. And so when they see that something opposes their understanding of that religion, I think it's much easier to reach that demographic than the average person who says, I don't particularly care about the animals, or I don't really particularly care about religious teachings. It's harder to say to them, you should care, right? It's almost easier to reach the people who say, I already care and I'm trying to be a good person. And this is my understanding of trying to be a good person, if that makes sense. You're then able to disrupt that a little bit and say, well, is it good? Is it acceptable? Is it okay? And when we bring to attention where halal rules came from, 1500 years ago, there it was a food desert. When Islam came, it was a literal desert. There were no grocery stores. There was no import export. And even at that time, Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, only ate animals once in a while. Some sources might say once every 2 weeks. Some will say once every 2 months. Some will say on a very rare occasion. Everybody agrees that he was plant forward. And so it's, once you're able to poke a hole in the concept of what halal is today and poke a hole in people's understanding of or association of halal with ethics, then it's fairly simple to convince them to be more plant-based at least. It's a bit of a learning curve. You have to relearn food, right? So it's difficult, and family and what everybody's used to eating and social occasions, it all becomes a little bit difficult. But what people find easier is to then start shifting their diet to a more plant-forward diet. And I've had so many folks express that. They'll try buying meat alternatives and try cooking with them and say, this meat alternative worked out well, but this one didn't work out so well. So I still need to find a replacement for this and this. Or folks will say, stopped eating red meat, and next I'll try to reduce my intake of other animal things that I'm eating. But that I find to be an easy objective to get to. So it's the best kind of advocacy that I personally have participated in, because it's just easier. We're just on the same page about where we want to go.
Do you get the feeling sometimes that there should be more Muslim vegans out there? That you're far too, of a small group. And what do you attribute that to?
I absolutely do think that we should have a lot more Muslim vegans, and I attribute the lack of vegan activism, advocacy, and engagement in our community with the fact that there is an overwhelming amount of halal now available, and this overwhelming concept of halal being associated with ethics, which we know is not. So I think that's really the culprit at hand, and I think dismantling that would go a long way for us. I have met people who will say things like, well, it's really, our duty is to buy halal. So if the halal folks are, hoodwinking us, then it's their responsibility. But it's a very rare person who will say something like that. The vast majority immediately will say, oh, this is not okay. And if people want to express their care in the way their actions are. And so I think we'll get there over time, but I think that we have our work cut out for us. I think that we need more activists understanding how to communicate with the Muslim community. We need more Muslim advocacy, and we need a more engaged Muslim advocacy. And I think, that would help light the fire, if you will, a little bit more effectively or faster. Help us scale.
Yes, I mean, going back to that comment of being culturally sensitive, I do feel that that argument should be made by a Muslim to a fellow Muslim. And it would be more effective than from a, your standard vegan to a Muslim. Although I do think that, your standard vegan who is doing the cube of truth out there should be aware that there is an argument to be made with, Muslim vegans. And that, there should be something like a flyer with all of the things you said about halal, for instance, that they could distribute to people.
I agree. I think that, while typically I would say folks, it's really important for the message that folks are re receiving from a specific community to be coming from within the community. However, in this case, animal farming is just so extensive, and we just don't have the halal industry so extensive, and non-Muslims are selling halal in order to capture the Muslim audience alongside other, because other consumers don't necessarily care if, the Boston pizza chain here is serving halal meat, right? They'll just eat it. So, but to target the Muslim community and make sure they're also eating there, they'll serve halal meat. And so we have a really big halal meat problem that is far more extensive. It's far more pervasive, and it's just out there, right? It's a little bit unhindered. We've had health gurus in the past, like Kevin Trudeau, in his book, speak about how halal meat is a more clean or healthier meat. So we have a problem of non-Muslims consuming and selling halal meat. And so we don't have a choice. We need to really, light the passion within vegan activists to be able to effectively reach Muslims, because otherwise, you're missing a quarter of the world's demographic, right? And so, when I speak with our fellow animal lovers and folks who advocate for animals regularly, I ask them or encourage them to arm themselves with knowledge, as I attempt to do, and I know they do as well, but I want them to arm themselves with knowledge specifically in regards to religion as well, because there are a whole ton of people who follow religious teachings when it comes to the way they consume animals. And the thing is you don't necessarily need to learn the religion yourself or learn all the finer points of it. You can just ask questions. What does halal mean? How do you know that halal animals are coming from farms that aren't like these slaughterhouses? How can you, what evidence do they provide of that? If it is in fact coming from this kind of a slaughterhouse and it's labeled halal, is that permissible for you to eat? There's so many questions, and that can help. It's deep canvassing work, really, is it can really help people consider and think about what halal means. And there's a couple of street activists that do such a great job, and their YouTube videos can go a long way to help inspire our fellow vegan advocates as well to speak to the Muslim audience. One of them is Earthling Ed. There is a bunch of videos with, if we just look up his videos on YouTube with vegan and halal, you'll find a couple of debates. And then there's also Joey Carbstrong, who's done really great work. And as a non-Muslim, he's able to communicate so well with the Muslim audience. Both of these gentlemen do a really, really great job. And I think, all vegan advocates need to be able to do that. And some of the vegan content can be easily repackaged to reach the Muslim audience, but some has to be mindful that, for example, pig slaughterhouses doesn't reach the Muslim audience. And so just making sure that when we are doing street activism, it's of course great to include pig, but it's also really pigs. It's really important to also make sure that there's content with cows and chickens, and if you have material on halal slaughterhouses or footage from halal slaughterhouses, that can just go a really long way in being able to connect with folks.
What about the language barrier? I know that George Hayek from Lebanese Vegan, he does post a lot of videos and stuff like that with Arabic subtitles. But there is that problem too, I guess, to reach those 2 billion Muslim people in the world.
I think the funders are doing a great job these days in reaching community members who are advocating within their own communities. And so, somebody in Bangladesh is going to make it relevant to their community, and George is going to make it relevant to his community. I tend to stick to the diaspora community, Muslim leaders and Muslim community members in Western countries who speak English. And so I think we need to just spread out in the areas where we are the experts and really concentrate on those and just make sure that our fellow Muslims in other parts of the world are also empowered and we're collaborating in great ways so that we can help achieve the goals that we're all interested in achieving.
We talked a lot about the food part, the diet part, but what about the rest? The zoo, I know that if you visit, some Middle Eastern countries and even North African countries, they will put you on the camel and you will visit, the fennecs on in cages and stuff like that. What about that part of animal exploitation that is not about diet?
When I'm engaging in advocacy, I do speak about animal testing or accessing or just making sure that our purchases are more aligned with ethics. So cruelty-free makeup, vegan makeup. And I find that many people tend to, when they're presented with an ethical option, they tend to go for the ethical option. But oftentimes it'll be so in a way where they're not compromising quality. So if there are ethical products, they'll tend to lean a little bit more towards the ethical products. There are many folks I know who are not vegan who don't go to the zoo because they don't like that animals are in cages or confined. And I think that there is, just like we do advocacy outside the Muslim community, it's quite the same within the Muslim community. There's many people who love animals and care for their well-being. And so when we position, look at what's happening to the animals that are confined, look how deeply traumatized they are, look at what humans are doing to animals. Many of them, upon understanding that the animal is being hurt, in question, they will often express care. And there's, of course, many who just simply don't care. So it's like activism in any community. And same goes for like wool. I remember in a group chat when my friends were speaking about wool, and they were saying, "Oh, wool, it's really cold, and you've got to get some wool socks." And I said, "Well, look, here's an investigation in wool farms, and this is what's happening on the wool farms." And they were like, "Oh no, okay, what else can we get?" And so there's definitely a desire for people often to do better once they know better.
Do you find that there is a segment of the Muslim community, or maybe a country, that does better than others in terms of animal welfare, even veganism?
Veganism, sure. We have the data that shows us where plant-based options are more available and more people are consuming plant-based and all of that, or ethical, right? However, I don't personally think so. I think that, in every corner of the world today, sadly, there is animal exploitation. It just takes on different faces sometimes. Sometimes it's a little bit more available for public consumption and a little bit, sometimes hidden away. But we've got animals being tested on in really, really cruel experiments. And I have no idea how these laboratories continue to operate in the developed world, right? Where we like to think that everything is so proper and done properly. But we know slaughterhouses are the stuff of nightmares here. So, yeah, I think it's the same everywhere, unfortunately, to some extent.
What are, I guess, the organizations out there that we should be supporting, that we should be highlighting, putting more, on sharing on our social media pages, that kind of stuff to add, to shed light on what is happening in terms of vegan advocacy directed to Muslim communities?
Oh, that's a tough one. There's so many great organizations. Green Islam, of course, has really great content. Middle East Vegan Society has really great content that's relevant to the community. And then there's also investigations done by non-Muslim organizations or activists that are also extremely relevant, like Joy Carbstrong did an investigation in halal farms. Just very recently, in a halal slaughterhouse, sorry, very recently. And it's really atrocious stuff and really can be used by Muslim advocates to highlight what's happening on halal or in halal facilities. Same thing with the US. There was a investigation there recently. So really, I think there's great organizations that are within the context of Muslim Islam teachings. However, there's also lots of really great stuff from outside the community. We really do need to be well-rounded as activists in order to be effective. And so knowing a little bit about health and, following our beloved Dr. Greger and other doctors that are doing great work is also just as important. So, yeah.
About the halal label, again, coming back quickly to it, I did read about the debate concerning how slitting the throat of the animal was considered particularly cruel, and how, there are Western governments that thought about, banning that. And of course, it also concerns kosher food in that instance. Do you have an opinion on that whole debate?
Well, I think that I would just like to I'd like to see animals not be seen as products or something to consume or less than humans. And so I'm personally a bit of a abolitionist. I just don't want to see animals used. And so when it comes to the format, that can look like various different formats. and there's many micro debates going on. But for me personally, it's really just about let's stop using it. Let's just leave the animals alone. It's not that hard. We really don't need to eat animals. We don't need to find new ways of abusing animals. We just can, right? We're trying to fit things into like a box so we can make it more palatable, and I just don't think that's necessary. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Or I'd love to know a little bit more. I don't if I'm allowed. I'd love to know a little bit more about your take on this and your journey to veganism, because you also come from a community that is as complex as the community I come from, right? So I'd love to hear your take as well.
Well, I guess what I would have to say is, yes, I was exposed to sacrificing, the sheep on those important holidays, and you cannot miss it. The streets can get bloody. It's that, graphic, literally. And I did witness also how people looked at animals as objects. I remember my neighborhood had lots of stray cats, and those stray cats were not considered people or sentient beings in a way. They were toys or they were curses, you know, if you were superstitious and they were the wrong color, or they were, you know, just nuisance and pests. And I guess, you know, it's interesting. I was asked the same question in my last episode, and I don't know how come I became vegan. I feel like veganism chose me instead of me choosing veganism, because I always had that little voice at the back of my mind saying, you know, this is weird. This is not good. And you should be thinking about, you know, getting away from it. And I guess the reason why I became vegan was I was never able to mute that voice. it stayed and it haunted me until I became vegan. So yeah, I do feel I was guided into it through those natural instincts that I was born with. And so yeah, I was really grateful to listen to your lecture, because then I thought I can reach out to some of my relatives who are, you know, Muslims and religious, and, you know, show them what you have developed as material, as content, as arguments concerning halal and other related topics. And before listening to your lecture, and by lecture I mean we both attended the AVA summit in Los Angeles a few months ago. Well, I never realized that this was missing in my life, that, you know, I did not have the tools to reach those family members. But now I do, which is, you know, which makes me feel very grateful for your work. So, yeah, I guess I hope I answered your question in some way.
You did. Thank you. I really appreciated hearing that.
As a way to end this conversation, I was wondering, you know, what maybe passage of the Quran or something, a saying from one of your favorite Islamic teacher or thinker, would you like to share with us that inspires you and feed that heart of compassion that so many activists like yourself have? Yeah.
You know, when I was around 19, 20, I started asking questions that, because to be frank, I find a lot of the understanding of the Muslim community around Islam unrelatable for myself personally. And so I looked into the anti-oppression teachings of Islam when I was 19, 20, and found a whole new world. And so I often joke that I'm a born-again Muslim, because I really did choose Islam. I was born into it and taught Islam, but I didn't really comprehend the teachings, and I didn't really comprehend the different ways of understanding the teachings until I was much older. And it really is animal rights that brought me closer to Islam. I remember the moment that I realized I had to go vegan. It was what flashed for me. I didn't believe what I thought was vegan propaganda around dairy. And I didn't want to go vegan. I was very comfortable being vegetarian, but I love milk chocolate and I love desserts, various cakes and all sorts of, you know, delicious desserts I was eating at the time. I did not want to let them go. And milk chocolate was probably my major food group at the time. I just love chocolate so, so much. And I have an allergy to dark chocolate. I can't tolerate dark chocolate or even semi-sweet chocolate. So I didn't want to let go of milk chocolate. And I was almost looking for reassurance that what I was watching was vegan propaganda. And I didn't really need to, you know, these people with an agenda, and I didn't really need to worry about making the switch to becoming dairy free. And I joined a Facebook group of the dairy farmers of Canada. And one of them, and I asked them questions about how they treat their animals, and everything they said was very reassuring. And I was feeling pretty confident that, okay, I'm okay with dairy. Dairy sounds fine. These people really care about their cows, and it's a very natural process. It's all good. It's all okay. And then one of them said, well, let me send you the cattle rearing manual that's nationalized for Canada. And I said, great, thinking I'm never going to read this. Who's going to read a cattle rearing manual? And yet I clicked on the PDF she sent me, and I perused. I just, scrolled through with no real intention of digesting it, really. But somehow my eyes landed on a passage that very clinically was describing that animals, or the cows, are very emotional creatures. And when their calves are extracted, it will have an impact on their lactation levels because they will feel depressed. So if you put all the mother cows together, they will comfort each other, and that will help raise the lactation level. And in that moment, I had an immediate realization in my brain. I said, oh shoot, I have to go vegan. And what I connected with in that second with Islam is that in the Quran, it says that animals are made in communities just like you, and they will be raised to their Lord at the end. They will be that essentially what that's saying is that they will testify on how we treat them on judgment day, right? And so we don't get to just mistreat animals and pretend it's okay. And that passage in the Quran, they're made in communities just like you. It was so blazing red hot for me, that passage in the Quran, that I've got to say that's probably my absolute favorite. I think that I am, no, I know that I am vegan because it says that in the Quran.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much, Sarah. Thank you so much for your time and for your great pioneering work. I'm so glad that you're part of this movement. And yes, thank you.
Likewise, my friend. Such a pleasure meeting you. Thank you for this conversation.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. I kindly invite you to share this podcast with the vegans you know. Let's encourage more people to take action. Again, thank you so much for caring. And I will see you next Tuesday for a new episode.